One of the hardest lessons to learn, I think, spiritually, is that God's silence is not the same thing as God's absence. God can be present with us, despite the fact that God may not be communicating directly to us, perhaps because it's too early for us to know something, or perhaps because we're not yet the people who can receive the message that God wants to give. And the only way to acquire the capacity to receive it is to live through something, endure through something, have the Spirit help us develop the capacities to be able to receive what God has to give.
Matthew Wickman is a professor of English at Brigham Young University. He served as the founding director of the BYU Humanities Center the past 10 years and is currently the host of this podcast, while also being the associate coordinator at BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. Matthew published an evocative book this year entitled Life to the Whole Being, the Spiritual Memoir of a Literature Professor. And his friend George Hanley, professor of comparative literature at BYU and former podcast guest, offered to turn the tables on Matt today and interview him about his new book. I'm Sophia Snyder, producer of the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Matt, for agreeing to allow me to flip the table on you and interview you about your book, because I feel very strongly. I suggested to you that we do this because after reading your book, Life to the Whole Being, which was published by the Maxwell Institute Living Faith series recently, I knew that we needed to have a conversation, and I knew that this book needed wide distribution and exposure. So let me just say a few words about it from my perspective and then invite you to comment a little bit about it in general terms.
Can I say one thing first,
yeah,
George?
Yeah, please.
You get both credit and blame for the book's existence. Really, you do, because you had this workshop a few years ago that was such a great workshop for Latter-day Saint graduate students, PhD students in the humanities, and you asked me to give like a devotional talk there. And that experience was really meaningful for me to talk with that group of students, that population, that demographic, about spiritual things. And I thought, you know, I'd like to write something more extensive like this. So the book really is an outgrowth of that opportunity. So thank you for inspiring the project in the first place.
Well, I'm thrilled to know that. I remember your speech very well, and I remember how grateful I felt that I had insisted to you to do it and to be personal in it. And I know that the personal part of this book was not an easy thing to to do for you or most people. But as you know, we're pretty hungry in the College of Humanities, our students are and our faculty are, for ways of thinking about what we do in the humanities from the perspective of faith and from the grounding that we have in the restored gospel. And I consider this book to be a real model of that. For those of you who are not familiar with the book, it's a combination or a weaving of Matt's own personal experiences and his journey of faith, but it is includes some brilliant readings of literature throughout the book, and is really a reflection on, you know, what we might sometimes call the workings of the Spirit, the mysteries of God's presence and actions in the world and in our lives. And I did find one quote that I kind of thought was sounded like a thesis statement to me about what the book's intentions are. And the quote goes like this: "The Spirit brings life to our whole being. We need thus to enhance our capacity to perceive and receive it across the breadth of its manifestations in all seasons of life, in good times and in bad." So in light of the fact that we hear a lot these terms, you know, some people identify as spiritual but not religious. I know some people who say they're religious but not spiritual. So for your purposes, what can you say about what you mean by spiritual or spirituality? And why is it an important element in a religious life?
Yeah, thanks, George. For me, at core, spiritual life just means our way of building a relationship with God. It means coming closer to what is divine, to what is sacred. And that is going to entail not just religious practice, though that's a very important part of a spiritual life, but will also entail a deepening of who we are, an expansion on our own capacities to think and to feel and to be and to dwell with other people and to take care of this planet in which we're living. All those things are part of a spiritual life. That phrase, life to the whole being, is a phrase I take from Parley P. Pratt, a 19th century church leader, who writes this wonderful passage about how the gift of the Holy Ghost, as he describes it, does things like quicken our intellectual faculties and increase, enlarge, expand, and purify our natural passions. It builds in our social feeling. It cultivates virtue and goodness and tenderness. It's a holistic view, really, of what spiritual life is. So for me, spiritual life is life lived to its fullest degree. And religious life is certainly an important component of that. So this book really is about relating. You know, how does one develop a fuller spiritual life in the context of living a religious life? And how does literature mediate those two things? That's, for me, where literature comes in.
So do you think, what really impressed me about the book was it gave articulation to things that I've maybe instinctively felt. I do actually remember reading that Parley P. Pratt quote on my mission, and I put it on an index card and taped it to my wall, among other quotes that I found over the course of my gospel study, but I don't think I really understood just how profound a statement that was, because of the ways in which it expanded far beyond within the religious context what we normally think of as the function of the Holy Spirit. And by that I mean things like it bears witness to the truth, it answers hard questions, it gives us guidance in our life choices. But Pratt's quote says it's so much more than that. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about why, in a religious context, we might run the risk of being religious but not spiritual, or in the sense that we might not fully understand the gift that we've been given.
That's a great way of putting it. You know, my experience, and tell me if this accords with yours, I find that most Latter-day Saints that I know have remarkably nuanced spiritual lives. I teach a class, for example, on literature and spiritual experience, and find that the students are incredibly attuned and alert to nuances of spiritual manifestation. But we tend to have far more nuanced lives than we do vocabulary in our church about how we tend to talk about spiritual things. We tend to reduce it to what, like, two really important components. The Spirit testifies to what's true, and it guides and directs us to know what to do. And that's essential and amazing. But if you think about your own relationship with God and the things to which you turn to God for, at least for me, they also involve things like acquiring the capacity to deal with complex situations, to endure suffering or pain or confusion better, learning how to see things differently or to love more fully or to deepen my empathy or to increase my capacity to think about something, to enliven my perceptions, to awaken my memories. I mean, all these things are things that are part of a spiritual life. And I find that Latter-day Saints have an intuitive grasp on these things, but not necessarily the same kind of vocabulary that we talk about commonly in our, you know, Sunday school lessons, you know, or the talks you hear on a given Sunday at church.
That's really fascinating. I mean, it does seem to me that without that vocabulary, there's a risk of are not being able to understand the spiritual dimensions or of our otherwise secular or ordinary life or our non-church related kinds of activities that you've just alluded to. So I'm wondering, I know that, you know, sometimes in a religious context, especially when I've talked to college students who are searching and finding their way in their faith, that they might have an overly specialized understanding of what the Spirit does. Maybe they don't, again, have the language for it. And it's helpful to point out to them that they may actually be more spiritual than they think, or they may be having the Spirit, or is it, you know, feeling the Spirit or experiencing God's presence in their life in ways that are not overtly religious, but are nevertheless drawing them, pulling them closer to God. So have you felt that, tell us a little bit more about why literature does that well for us, and why you as a scholar of literature turn to literature, poetry in particular, with such spiritual dedication in this book, and why you would make an argument for why literature should be, can be, an important component of anyone's spiritual life. You don't have to be majoring in English. You don't have to be an English professor to do this.
That's right. You know, literature for me, I've loved it since I was a kid. I was a reader as a kid, you know, like a lot of people were. But I really came to appreciate it as a missionary in France and in the aftermath of that mission. You know, I was a missionary in a place, a foreign country, and just kind of starting to learn about the world and learn about people and things. And literature, I found, especially later when I returned home and began really thinking about what that experience had meant to me and about what I wanted to do in the world and about the world around me, just what it meant. Literature, it became pretty clear, was a really, really sophisticated instrument of expression that could teach us about things that we most value, what it means to be human, who we are as people, who other cultures are, what that all is and means. And it also, pretty clearly for me, was a way to understand God and God's creation more completely, to understand ourselves more completely is to understand God more completely, to understand other people more completely is to know God more completely. So that literature became for me a way, a vehicle for developing spiritual capacities. Heightened my capacity to think in new, imaginative ways. It helped me attend more fully to the things I was perceiving in the world. It assisted me in gazing, you know, kind of around corners or across horizons, you know, things I didn't yet fully grasp, but kind of intuit through someone's experience captured in a poem or captured in a novel. And as I say in the book, literature finally is a revelatory exercise. I mean, through literature, we really come to see the world in new ways. And revelation is very important to our religious practice as Latter-day Saints, as you know. Literature in its own way is a vehicle for that kind of experience. It reveals new things to us all the time.
Did you initially think of it that way? Or, I mean, were there times when you were reading literature as an undergraduate or even in graduate school or even in your early career where you thought, okay, I'm stepping away from my religious life and now I'm stepping into secular discourse and I'm being pressed to see and imagine the world other than the way I see and understand it as a religious person. And in some cases, right, that feels like almost a contradiction to your own lived experience or a challenge to it in some way. So I'm wondering if you always saw it as a spiritual exercise or sometimes felt that it was other, and how did you kind of come around to embracing it and articulating it as you have here as something that's pretty core to who you are as a Latter-day Saint?
That's a good question, George. You know, in my case, one of the outcomes from my experience as a missionary in France was I really learned to at least try to seek God's inspiration to help me be better, to help me understand things more fully. And I brought that home with me in my mission. It became a way I would approach everything that I did, including my studies. So when I was studying literature, you know, as an English major, as an undergraduate, for example, or in graduate school, I mean, you know, days begin for me with prayer where I'm saying, please help me understand what I'm looking at. These ideas.
Because you don't want to fail the class. You want to impress
exactly
your professor.
Right.
You want to be successful, you know, in
that's
life.
That's right. And reading a lot, especially a lot of philosophy and theory, I thought these ideas are too big. Help me understand this. So in a way, I always turned to God to help me understand what I was seeing. And I would often find, you know, kind of like spiritual insights coming then to me through what I was reading. So those things were always linked for me. You know, I saw.
And is that, sorry to interrupt, yeah, but is that independent of whether or not the writer was him or herself a religiously minded or oriented writer?
Completely independent. I got to tell you, I think my favorite passage of scripture is found in the Gospel of John, chapter 20, like verses 11 through 18 or something like this. This is when Mary Magdalene's at the tomb. I love that episode where Christ appears to her and she mistakes him for the gardener, right? What I love about that is it shows Christ coming to Mary, speaking to her from out of what she takes to be a secular situation, a worldly situation. I find that really exciting. I've found God speaking through things that are texts that are religious texts, but also texts that are deeply secular texts. That God speaking out of things that are not overtly religious is something I find to be inherently exciting. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's fascinating.
And is that your experience too? I've got to ask you.
Definitely. I mean, I think there were long periods, though, where I stuck with an idea or an author or a set of questions, you know, going to the point where I was writing my dissertation and writing my first book, and I wasn't thinking necessarily, and I certainly wasn't writing about what was relevant about what I was reading to my religious experience or to my understanding of God, because I wasn't actually, that was inappropriate to do in most of the classes I was taking. I was educated in, you know, wicked secular institutions like Stanford and Berkeley and not at BYU. But I think there were times when it felt like I was a little bit in a desert, you know, like I don't know what I'm doing here, but I do know I'm trying to understand this issue. In my case, my first book was about the experience of the history of slavery mm-hmm. as it impacted literature from the Caribbean and the United States. But I ended up writing a book that featured testimonial language and genealogy as major themes in the book and in the literature I was seeing. And so I kind of had this epiphany that, oh, I'm glad I stuck with this as long as I did. And it bore some spiritual fruit to me. And on a deep intuitive level, I think I always trusted I was still in terrain that God cared about. Certainly I was mourning over what I was reading about the experience of enslaved peoples in these areas and what their courage, what kind of courage it required of them and so on. I felt God's compassion the whole time, but it wasn't always clear to me how it related. But over time, it came back. So let me ask you, because it seems like you, in some ways, have come full circle in that, you know, when you first started writing about literature and reading it, as a young person, you weren't necessarily, I don't know, maybe you had some exercises in some classes you had where you were given that opportunity. But now you wrote very personally about, and very overtly religiously about the literature you're reading. So tell us about how, because you had not developed that skill in, it had never been asked of you as a literary critic to write about your own personal spirituality or your own wrestle with God, and yet you're doing it in this book, presumably for the first time. So tell us about what that meant to you and why that was an important stage in the development of your thinking.
Yeah, I appreciate that, George. How do I answer this question the right way? When I began teaching this class on literature and spiritual experience, which I found to be such a different kind of class to teach, but so incredibly rewarding because it touched on all areas of life for the students and for me. Yes, academic life, certainly, but also religious life, spiritual life, life in relationship, etc. I thought, I want to write about this. And when I began writing about it, I found the writing was totally flat, completely failing. It really stunk. And I thought, what's not working here? And the answer is I was writing like an academic would. And that's not bad. I write that way too about this subject matter. But this book needed to be more personal. It needed to kind of tie things together through my personal experiences. And that's how I began writing, you know, more personally about this. To give an example of what this is like, maybe read a passage. This is a passage where I take a poem by the poet R.S. Thomas. This is chapter 7, a chapter called Holy Saturdays. And here's an example of what this looks like in the book. Okay, page 110. Where are we and why? These are questions frequently posed by the 20th century Welsh poet R.S. Thomas. Some critics refer to Thomas as the poet of Holy Saturday, the day between Christ's crucifixion and the resurrection. This is when Christ went and preached unto the spirits in prison, connoting in some Christian traditions elaborate theologies regarding Christ's union with the dead. More simply, Holy Saturday attests to the reality of worldly suffering, to hopes dashed and not yet resolved through the glories of the resurrection. It is thus the decisive day within the Christian narrative that confronts the believer with the full power of worldly suffering and its apparent victory over the powers of good. In the Holy Saturday moments of our lives, you find ourselves wrestling with divine silence and absence. Divine silence can be deeply perplexing, and Holy Saturday evocatively captures its implications. Cutting down a bit, I read a poem by Thomas called Kneeling. It's a beautiful poem. I'll read this. It's brief. Here's the poem. Moments of great calm, kneeling before an altar of wood in a stone church in summer, waiting for the God to speak. The air a staircase for silence. The sun's light ringing me as though I acted a great role. And the audience's still. All that close throng of spirits waiting as I for the message. Prompt me, God, but not yet. When I speak, though it be you who speak through me, something is lost. The meaning is in the waiting. From here, I talk a bit about what that poem means, you know, at the things where the poem is set in a church, what the speaker is awaiting, inspiration for a sermon or a prayer, but how the poet is waiting in kind of a happy way for what the inspiration he's going to receive, which he anticipates. And then here's where it's personal for me, or more so. These positive associations give the poem a happy, expectant feel, but behind this optimism are more sobering thoughts, Holy Saturday thoughts. For, as the poet confesses, when I speak, though it be you who speak through me, something is lost. That is, his transcriptions of the divine word distort it, obscure it, producing the wrong kind of silence, gaps in the sacred message. Is he even worthy, then, to receive what he awaits? If he does, how will he do it justice? So his waiting involves trepidation, and perhaps, too, a small measure of dread. For to be graced by inspiration is to risk being opened to God, changed by God, in ways we cannot control. But then again, what if the inspiration he awaits, that we await, does not arrive? Or what if it does, but it still seems beyond us, such that its meaning becomes uncertain? How would we tell the difference between inspiration beyond our capacities and inspiration that never came at all? What if we were changed not by what touched us, but by what failed us or we it? What if we were open, but were simply left waiting? What if that waiting were all the meaning we ever had? And the book goes from there into a personal experience I had with some friends when I was in my 20s that really kind of changed how I thought about their life experience and about the difficulty of waiting in silence for things we just don't understand, an experience I had over many, many years. So that's an example of the literature kind of mediating between spiritual life and my personal experience.
I'm so glad you shared that. And that passage is an excellent example of how I think what you do in this book is provide a context in which people's spiritual struggles make spiritual sense, right? Rather than thinking of the waiting or the silence that we sometimes feel from God or the inexplicability of some of our experiences, the really hard things that are nevertheless omnipresent in our lives and central to who we are and how we feel about ourselves, I think what you do in this book is provide a context for people to understand that that is part of the journey and that that is not antithetical to what it means to trust and to believe in revelation, to believe in answered prayers, to believe in guidance from God. And that may be
That's exactly right.
One of the most important things about this. And I don't know if you intended that or not, but I feel like the book really provides for anyone dealing with contradiction and nuance in their life that or complexity in their life that's really hard to have the vocabulary and understanding as to why that's not a contradiction of the of the promises of the gospel or of the simple things of the gospel that we learn in primary.
Thank you for saying that. That's so well said, George. Yeah, you're exactly right. This is not a book that provides a lot of easy answers. It's not a how-to book, you know, that spells out how you build a spiritual life. I do think it wants to model what a spiritual life is and all of its nuance, its complexity, at times its difficulties, struggles, but also its high points. It models trying to sit with that kind of complexity, and part of that sitting means learning how to wait, sometimes what feels like God's silence. One of the hardest lessons to learn, I think, spiritually, is that God's silence is not the same thing as God's absence. God can be present with us, despite the fact that God may not be communicating directly to us, perhaps because it's too early for us to know something, or perhaps because we're not yet the people who can receive the message that God wants to give. And the only way to acquire the capacity to receive it is to live through something, endure through something, have the Spirit help us develop the capacities to be able to receive what God has to give. So that is a really key feature to spiritual life. Thank you for giving that such good expression.
Well, you gave it expression throughout the entire book, and I think it's an important aspect of it to underscore. And maybe we could explore this a little bit further, because you are articulating, when you describe what spirituality is or spiritual experiences, you say you describe them as intensifications of experience. And that means they're also more varied, right, in the way that maybe an exploding center moves outward in every direction, right? And so you may end up feeling more intense love, but more intense grief, right? You may feel more connected to God, but also more pained at those moments when you don't feel as connected. And that can sometimes mean that the spiritual journey is one in which you do expose yourself to greater suffering and greater contradiction. So, I mean, maybe just to be flippant, why would I want that?
That's right. Yeah.
Why wouldn't I just want to keep things simple? Why would I want that intensification? I think we're actually really profoundly frightened by that, actually.
I think that's right. You know, people who study spirituality scientifically and look at sort of neurocognitive qualities that we associate with spiritual states of being talk about intensification, that what a spiritual sort of state of being does is it deepens the imagination, it heightens and speeds up cognition, it deepens emotions, awakens memory and imagination, links them together. It intensifies the mind. It's spiritual experiences the mind at its most fully fully developed state. I think in terms of spiritual life, though, you think about what it would mean, what it means in Scripture to come closer to the presence of God, all right? Think about like Peter, James, and John when Christ is transfigured. This is Matthew 17, I think it is. You know, when they see the transfigured Christ, they're not relieved by this. They're freaked out by it. They're scared by it, right? It's too big to take in. I think in the same way, in much more modest ways, for most of us, to try to build a spiritual life is to feel a love from God that is utterly unique and radically self-affirming. But it's also to be asked to do things that are a little bit difficult, to take you outside of your comfort zone. That can mean feeling things more deeply in your own life or the lives of others. It can mean recognizing what your weaknesses are more acutely and where you're falling short of what maybe you could or should be doing. It means feeling more pain for the suffering outside of you. It means being maybe prompted to do things that take you outside your comfort zone. And why you do that, why you would want it, as I'm sure you experience in your own lives, because, well, if you felt prompted by God to do those things, if you felt the love of God for you and for others by drawing closer to God, what other choice do you have? You know, you say, yes, I'll do that, come what may for the consequences.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. I think one of the implications of your book that I found very important for me personally was that, I mean, not only do you show how you draw spiritual lessons from literature, but you also show how you draw them from people, and people who are in more painful positions in some cases than you feel you are, but you love them and you love that literature, and you feel you incorporate those experiences into your life, and you make your life richer and deeper. So it does seem to me that this sort of amplified understanding of the spirit that Parley P. Pratt is describing and that you are exploring so thoroughly in this book implies that if I shut myself off from sources of spirituality that are unexpected, or maybe even in corners of life or in lives that would not normally jump out at us as places to go or people to turn to get answers from God. Do you know what I'm saying?
I feel like you are
I felt reminded that I need to look for God, you know, in the phrase from the New Testament, in the countenances of the least of these. I have to go anywhere. And then the good news is I can go anywhere and find Christ. I can listen, if that's my intention, right?
That's exactly right.
If I'm trying to grow closer to Him, I'm not going to do it if I block off a certain group of people or certain types of people or certain ways of experiencing life that are very different from mine.
That's exactly right. I mean, and make an analogy, you could imagine the world as an elaborate musical instrument, and God can create music in any corner of it, and different kinds of music too, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, for sure. I mean, what you said is exactly right.
Totally. And it's you say that it's healing, right? You say
I do.
That literature and other people's experiences provide the very healing for the wounds that they may also cause you.
Yeah, I think that's right. These experiences do cause healing. Spiritual experience, you know, God can, I believe, in my own experience, if these experiences of coming closer to God also reveal our weaknesses, or they reveal areas of problem or struggle in the world, it means that they open us to pain. But the Spirit is also a great healer. And God finds ways then to always reassure and to heal in the context of these things that cause pain, in my experience. So that, you know, if you find yourself loving somebody who is going through just awful things and you can't make it better, that's painful. But there's also with that a reassurance of God's love for that person and greater promise ahead for that person and for others. And that's an example of the kind of healing that I feel from those spiritual interactions.
Yeah, and I think you make it clear. I have a quote here, and I don't have the page number, but you say literature, like literature, spiritual experiences, quote, are often at their most impactful, not in imparting wisdom, but in measuring the distance between our expectations and our actual experiences of the things of God. That's an important teaching component to this. You also throughout the book make it very clear that the most important revelation I think that God gives us is His love rather than necessarily His understanding. And so sometimes, to my mind, that's when I asked, why would I want this? It seems to me that I would want to know what God's love is like. And if I could experience it, nothing could be more joyful, even though that also means it will bring more sorrow into my heart because of the compassion I feel for myself or for others. But God's power is available to us to kind of help cover those gaps or cover that distance.
That's right, yeah. You read one little thing here on these kind of gaps that open from spiritual life, and then comment on what you said about God's love. This is from middle chapter of the book, chapter 6. To some extent, all literature comes from brokenness, from the breakdown in systems of expectation and meaning, from complexity introduced into simplicity. It is born from the complexity, the beguiling uniqueness, even of simple things, love, loss, hope. Without brokenness and the gaps it opens, we would have no need for literature, no need for any story or image showing how life may be or always is otherwise, but neither would there be any spiritual experience, any imperative to lay aside the things of this world and seek for the things of a better. spiritual experience is literary in part because it comes from and then sometimes causes our brokenness. It reminds us that we too may always be or already are otherwise. Mm. It's a growth-inducing exercise. Literature is spiritual experience, spiritual life. You know, you and I both, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and, you know, Christ's central role here in spiritual life is key in helping us remember of the things that we can overcome with Christ's help. Christ's atoning sacrifice, which is ultimately the power that brings forth a resurrection, but that also in day-to-day life makes healing possible in all kinds of ways.
Well, maybe I'll end with this question, which is one of my favorite insights that I got from the book, but I want to hear you say more about. You say something that I think might strike some religious and even non-religious people as very counterintuitive. You say that behind every doctrinal treatise, and I don't know if this isn't an exact quote, but it's close, behind every doctrinal treatise are more novels and poetry waiting to be written. Why is that the case? And that's so exciting to me, because then that says to me, well, I guess, why is that the case? And then maybe what does it mean that as a Latter-day Saint community, we're not writing enough of those poems and novels?
Yeah, you know, our faith tradition is one that believes in the centrality of revelation, right? We never fully have the mind of God, which means by definition there's always more that God can reveal. God can entirely pop open our minds or entirely change the conversation or provide new direction. So that behind everything that we understand, and I do believe we come to understanding of the things of God, I believe that very much, but behind every understanding, there's another sense that there's more that might be revealed. When I feel as though I draw close to God or receive an answer to prayer, I always feel as though whatever answer I'm receiving, behind it, there's a lot more that God might have said, I just wasn't ready for it, or God didn't want to say it. In that respect, you know, there are worlds beyond the world that we currently imagine. The world that we imagine it and can explain to ourselves scientifically, philosophically, theologically, beyond that world, there are more worlds still out there. And that sense of what's beyond what we know right now, to me, that kind of captures the spirit of what literature does. It attunes us to the worlds that are yet to be born, both in our societies, but also in ourselves, in our relationships, in our lives.
I love that. I think of the Book of Mormon critique of people who are content with the Bible. We have a Bible. And of course, Latter-day Saints could say, the Book of Mormon, we have the Book of Mormon, or we have the restored gospel, we don't need anything more. Yeah. And yet the message of the Book of Mormon and of the restored gospel seems to me to be a call to gather and to pursue and lay hold of every good thing. And if there's a spirit of contentment, then that's all the spirit that we have. I mean, Paul says we should be content, but we should also feel need at the same time.
Yeah.
So I think they're not contradictory to say, I love what has been given and what has been restored, but precisely because I love it, I look for more.
Yeah.
I have the imagination to prepare myself for that.
Right. Restore gospel means to be grateful for what God's revealed, but to be aware, by definition, not all is yet revealed, right? Or at least, at the very least, not all is known yet to you or to me. Yeah, that's what that means to be a member of the church, I think. It means to need to be open to what is not yet here, that what God may want to reveal.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for letting me flip the table and interview you on this important occasion of the publication of this book. And I do hope that our listeners will look at it and give it a good read. I think it is one of the most important books written by a Latter-day Saint that I've read in many years, and certainly one of the most unique in the way in which it helps flesh out why literature should be an important part of our lives. And those of us who love literature understand that instinctively, but I think you've given it some really powerful clarity for us.
Well, thank you, George, and thank you for offering to kind of interview me for this podcast. It was a table flipping experience. I wasn't going to do it, but when you offered, I thought, you know, that's such a generous invitation, and I have so much respect for you and the work that you do, George. You've been a great example to all of us in the college. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.